Thanks to Joan and thanks to Jimmy for keeping such things alive. Thanks to all of you for showing up for such stuff. So much of America is plastic and preformed, and these kinds of events aren't so. And thanks to Wendy and Diane and Robert for their beautiful poems. And so it's a pleasure to be here. Most of the readings that I give, I start with a poem by William Stafford, a poet that was very influential in me trying to figure out what I hope to do in the art. So it's called The Way It Is by William Stafford. There's a thread you follow. It goes among things that change, but it doesn't change. People wonder about what you're pursuing. You have to explain about the thread, but it's hard for others to see. While you hold it, you can't get lost. Tragedies happen, people get hurt or die, and you suffer and get old. Nothing you do can stop time's unfolding. You don't ever let go of the thread. And I imagine, right, that's what we're all trying to do as we follow the art that calls us. So I'm the grandson of two farmers from the Depression era. On my father's side, and that was the grandparents I was closest to, my grandfather had a first grade education, and my grandmother had a fourth grade education. My grandfather started driving a mule team with his father at six in 1906 down in Greensburg, Kentucky. My father ended up being a veterinarian, so I grew up around animals. And I've never known a time when I'm not in a place where I can be in the woods most of my time. That's the environmental studies. So the first poem's called Taxonomy, and I hope somewhere along the line you had to do some identification in taxonomies to figure out what species you belong to, at least, right? So taxonomy. We've been taken captive by the world, named by it, taught to eat from its table. The whetted blade slides through the flesh, thin veil that parts to reveal what we think is the soul. We set fires and burn the earth because berry canes won't come back without dirt as dark as the color of its fruit. Before the oldest trees were felled, we traveled the watercourse. Now, in the open fields, we track coyote, hoping to save the sweet lambs we tend. Sadly, as night stumbles down, all we find are clumps of wool caught in Teasel's fine comb. More than two centuries ago, Linnaeus began to arrange all the names we've given back to the world. This is how we know black walnut hulls, when crushed, smell like lemon. Or when we walk through sweet fern, grouse will burst into flight, dragging the plant's sharp scent into the air. Near the stream, a tulip poplar blows down, leaves turning the yellow of mustard and ragwort. Despite the order we've cultivated, the charts we've set to memory, we're likely to discover our way is one of unknowing. When we die, may we be a pleasing word placed in the mouth of the world. So I love classical Chinese poetry, and so sometimes those poets, you know, some from 500, 600, 700 years wind up in my poems. If you don't know about Li Po's demise, supposedly, right, he died drunk on rice wine, chasing after the moon's reflection in the water. And so where I live, there are about 41,000 acres of game lands above our home to the west of us, and so bear come into our neighborhood, and we have wild turkey. Deer were just in my garden two nights ago. Fisher and mink and on and on and on. The Little Juniata River, which feeds into the Juniata River and later on in Susquehanna and Chesapeake Bay, it runs right behind our house too. So our boys as well as I spend a lot of time in the Little J. So this is thinking of Li Po while fishing the Little J. I've known fishermen who have died in the river, drunk on wine, trying to embrace the moon's reflection. I've known others fished out of the water who cried after their own deaths when the moon disappeared behind a cloud. This evening, just before dark, the moon's hand made rough brushstrokes on the river's paper surface, and trout, intoxicated on green caddisflies, slept in an eddy beneath the fallen body of a willow. In their dreams, these fish waited for the wind to rise, for chokecherry blossoms to be cast upon the water, flowers purling around stone, as beautiful and white as the hands of the dead. So if you don't know the poet, Pennsylvania poet, Harry Humes, definitely go home and Google Harry Humes. He taught at Kutztown State for many years, still alive, still writing good poems. I don't know if Harry is now in his early 80s. It's late 70s for sure, if not early 80s. This poem, he grew up the son of a coal miner. So this poem is called Coal, and it's for Harry Humes. Coal. The bottom of the world and the sounds that reside there, the music beneath the sounds, beneath the world. Because I can't tell where the world begins and we end, I keep the house cold, knowing to burn the lamp is to change the insides of the mountain to ash. We're told that to repent means to turn around, like a bulldozer scraping the edge, like the darkness of slurry against a dam, like men running in a shaft of light as the black seam catches fire. I am a hunter for environmental reasons, so if you ever want to hear about the environmental reasons behind hunting, I'll be happy to share that with you. I live in a hunting culture, obviously, up in central PA, this is a poem that comes out of that culture. It's called Accident. They tell the son, who tells his friends at school, that the father's death was an accident, that the rifle went off while he was cleaning it. I'm not sure why he couldn't wait. We understand the ones who decide to leave us in February, even as late as March. Snows swell, sun disappears, hunting season ends. With two deer in the freezer, any family can survive. I know sometimes it feels like you've come to the end of something. Sometimes you just want to sit down beneath a hemlock and never go back. But this late in the year, when plum trees have opened their blossoms, yesterday it was so warm we slept with the windows open, smell of forsythia right there in the room. I swear you could hear the last few open, silk petals come undone, a soft sound like a pad sliding through a gun's barrel, white cloth soaked in boar cleaner, removing the lead, the copper, the carbon that fouls everything. My son knows you don't die cleaning your rifle. The chamber's always open. I told him to nod his head anyway when his friend tells the story, to say yes as many times as it takes, to never forget the smell of smoke and concrete, the little bit of light one bulb gives off in a basement with no windows. So my dear wife's here, Shelley. 7 days from now, we'll celebrate our 26th wedding anniversary. I've had a crush on her since I was 12. That's when she moved into our school district. This poem's about Shelley, so she's very kind that she... I don't know if she allows me to read these things, but she doesn't divorce me for reading such things. So, remember, I'm the son of a veterinarian, and so I'm used to animals in rut, right? Estrus, and if you're from a hunting culture, you know, at least with white-tailed deer, when rut takes place. Maybe you don't know, it's not rut because it's not a mammal, but July and August is when you'll have timber rattlesnakes. Males will travel 6 to 8 miles to find a female. So we have various animals in rut in here, including a human animal, I guess. So, craving. In the dust of a February snow, the coyote's track follows the deer's track. He sees in the hoof-dragged line of her stride a weariness that lengthens with winter's spiteful width, a labor he longs to release with the clean tear of canine, easy flow of artery. Along the banks, the river runs faster, snow melt and the quickening of time as sun throws down more light each day. A mink scores its trail, countering the river's course, and every 20 yards, a pool of piss, sugared with blood, with estrus's craving. We're always giving ourselves away, smallest parts of our bodies flying through space, neutrinos hauling the blood and dust and piss of our existence. How surprised the buck was when he approached my wife, her menses thick in his nostrils. And even when he realized her bottom was clothed, no doe's red vulva beckoning, he could not turn away. The coyote must be fed, the mink joined to her mate. My wife ran the dirt trail back to our house, collapsed, and later laughed at her own allure. Alone, wind coming up from the river, the buck must have raised his head, barely aware of the heart's insistent thump, as he tried once again to catch the stinging scent that spurs us on. That is true. I could not have dreamed up, right, my wife being approached by a buck. Another poet I like a lot is Robert Wrigley, West Coast poet. Actually born in the Midwest, lived in Illinois, but very early in his career moved out to the West. And so this one is for Robert Wrigley. The title is Imago Dei, and so maybe if you went to catechism, you know Imago Dei. The weasel who lives along the water's edge splits the muskrat's vein, jugular blood stringing the back of the head, mouth shut until death's jaw hinge opens the throat so tongue may lap warmth and salt. What's left of the idea we were made in the image of God? Stomach red with joy, ears raised to guard against the approach of another. Like the muskrat, our flesh comes undone. And like the weasel god, our bloodlust is lost in briar. Or beneath the dirt roofs of these muddy dens we call heaven. So 4 years ago, in about a month, my father died of pancreatic cancer. He was 81 and a half. He lived a very good long life. Only 4 months before he died, we were up over 12,000 feet skiing on double black diamond runs out in Colorado together. He had some abdominal pain and went home early. He usually would ski from November until May for a checkup, and they found pancreatic cancer. So this poem is in response to that. What I told my sons after my father died. The emptiness of the catalpa flower's mouth opens into nothing, stamen encased by cream. My father called it a weed tree, despite his love for the light it provided in June, the colors it caught as dark came down over the garden we tended. The way he told the story, after my great-great-grandfather escaped from a Confederate prison, he traveled north by night along creek beds. He rested beneath the draped boughs of catalpa, drank branch water, and ate pawpaws. Supposedly in dark's false stillness, he could tell the difference between a hound and a groundhog, that in the water's hushed movements, he could pick out the stones breaking the surface of the stream long before dawn woke those who hunted him. In trying to explain the stillness, I don't wish to add to my son's sorrow. If I could play three notes upon the fiddle, I'd do that instead. When my first boy was born, in the nights after we brought him home, I stood above his crib, head pressed over the rail, to assure myself he still breathed. I did the same when I was a kid working at the animal hospital. I'd open a cage, my ear flush with the chest of a dachshund or Doberman, and listen to the heart after the strain of surgery, as it settled back into a sound like a kick wheel turning clay. My father taught me the names for trees, which in turn I've taught my sons. That's what it was like after he stopped breathing. A bee disappears down the flower's mouth. Although we can't see it, the bee's still there. And it just happens the catalpas are just about past in their blossoming, but you could still find one in blossom if you want to go examine their beautiful trumpet-shaped blossoms. So hunting should never be easy. And one of the things I've taught my sons is if you can take a life of any sort easily and it doesn't bother you, then you should stop hunting. And so I suppose this poem comes out of that sort of ethos. It's called Hermetic. The man walks into the woods with a rifle on his shoulder, says nothing to the boy who has followed him there. For safety, the chamber is empty, bullets in the breast pocket of his jacket. After more than 5 hours listening to the sound of limbs with no leaves, they hear a deer picking her thin legs through windfalls and the striped canes of moosewood's last growth. The man presses the line of a finger to his lips, and the boy puts gloved hands over his ears as the noise of black powder and metal disappears. The woods dissolve into a different quiet than before, and the man tells the boy to stay in the stand while he goes to the animal's side. Because the body lies askew, he places her twisted legs beneath the torso, brings her head back to true, and before the knife relieves the body of its burden, bends to the hole the bullet has made, whispers into the growing circle of blood a prayer to be forgiven for all the things he cannot pray. And on the top of those game lands I mentioned, of 41,000 acres, just as the Allegheny Front and the Plateau begins, lots of strip mining took place up there, as well as some deep tunnel mining before the strip mining. And this poem comes out of that place, has a long title, sort of like Robert had a long title. So, fishing for largemouth in a strip mining reclamation pond near Lloydsville, Pennsylvania. The gills rake down the sides of his head, and the mouth opens like the tunnels we used before the coal companies hauled in dozers and trucks to scrape away the mountain our grandparents had known. There was honor in riding rail cars underground, something mythic as fathers said goodbye to their children and traveled away from the sun. Our teachers told us the story of Sisyphus, and we understood how a stone might roll back upon the one who pushed it. Most of the tunnels are gone, filled in or forgotten, holes in our memory where the black line of money vanished, like the wind that sweeps over the backside of the Alleghenies. As penance, the state made us dig out this pond in the shape of a kidney, water the color of liver, banks covered in cattails and loose strife. On the mounds of dirt that were left, goldenrod grows in thin circles, like yellow mustard on bologna, the white bread of cloudy skies balanced on the horizon where red oak and hemlock should be. Black birch is the only tree that comes up, rises toward the sun's lure, like a bass striking the plastic popper my son dragged across the pond's surface, bait imitating a frog's ragged dance, enticing this fish he hooked and grips by the lower lip. Both of them smiling or grimacing or simply trying to hold still for the camera. And I'll close with a poem that's a bit of a prayer and a bit of a blessing. William Blake was said to have stated what comes at the end of this poem. And so the poem's called A Prayer for My Sons, after a line of reported conversation by the poet William Blake to a child seated next to him at a dinner party. So a prayer for my sons and for you. If I could send the sun sprawling from my mouth, if each night the moon might drop from my eyes onto your head, if I could reach up and take a star whose light has traveled toward you for thousands of years and place it under the bed where you sleep, I would do all these things But being a man who has seen no angels and who at times doubts what he's been told in church, I'll simply ask what the poet asked, that God would make this world as beautiful to you as it has been to me. Thanks.